Hey y'all, this is Emily from Night Call. Hope y'all are staying safe and healthy out there. What you're about to hear is coming straight from the Night Call Patreon feed. It is our first ever Night Call Movie Club episode. We are super excited to share it. And if you like this episode, you can find more where that came from by going to our Patreon at patreon.com/nightcall. We're going to be doing two bonus episodes every month, including our movie club and our book club. So check that out if you like this. But without further ado, here's our first ever movie club episode with special guest Ryan Johnson. Enjoy.
It's 11:59 p.m. at the Very Large Array in New Mexico, and you're listening to the Night Call Movie Club.
Hello, and welcome to our inaugural episode of the Night Club. Oh my God, I'm doing this over and over and over again. I'm going to keep it in this time. Just keep it real. Keep it all on the tape. This is the inaugural episode of the Night Call Movie Club, our new series that we're doing for our Patreon subscribers. Thank you all so much for subscribing and supporting the podcast. We are super excited to have these new bonus episodes for you. We are now doing not one, but two bonus episodes a month. So we will be back with another book club next month, and then a wild card. Who knows? So it'll be fun. But hi, I am Emily Yoshida. I am here in Los Angeles in full-on quarantine. And with me on the other end of the line are
Molly Lambert and
Tess Lynch.
And we have a very special guest to kick off the movie club this month. Joining us to talk about Contact, we have filmmaker and friend of the pod, Ryan Johnson. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, what's up, Night Call?
What's up, Ryan?
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
How's your quarantine going?
It is exactly like yours.
Okay.
Literally, exactly. It's a photostatic copy of yours, I promise.
Ryan, how is your sourdough bread journey?
Oh, okay. So it's good. I've made... So Molly actually, when she was over at our place, left the tartine bread book, which is a kind of like a incredible tome. It's like it basically like the first 80 pages are just like the first bread recipe. It gets very like spiritual about bread, and this is like it's just I'm a moth to the flame with this kind of thing. This is what I live for. So I've been cultivating my own sourdough starter for the past couple of weeks. And I made my first loaf. It came out, Molly, I sent you a picture of it. It came out pretty good. It's a little denser than I would like. And I'm not sure if that's a rising thing or if that's the starter was not. This is the kind of high quality content that the movie, that the Night Call Movie Club is all about. But anyway, all to say, first one was pretty good. I'm going to try again soon. But people have also, because everybody is fucking baking right now, people have been giving us so much bread. We've just got, our freezer is filled with other sourdough loaves. So when we run low, I'll try another one and let you know.
A sourdough starter feels like the opposite thing that you want to be passing around during a pandemic. But I also would love to have a sourdough starter right now, even though bread baking is very daunting to me.
You're happy to, if we can figure out some kind of tube system to get it to you. Yeah, I've got because you throw away 80%. It's like keeping a pet, basically. You feed
right.
it and you train it. So you throw away 80% of it. I've got plenty of starter if you want it. It's also very easy to make, though.
Yeah.
I'm too intimidated is what I realized about sourdough. It's just too scientific, too many things that could go wrong. I'm afraid.
Well, this is such a good segue to today's movie.
Yeah.
Science and fear. So earlier in the month, those of you who've been subscribed to the Patreon know we did Contact, Carl Sagan's Contact, for our book club. And we were all really into it. And so we decided to follow it up with watching Contact the movie, which I had seen before I read the book multiple times. And so I was reading the book for the first time as a big fan of the movie. So it was fun to go back and rewatch the movie now, having read the book. Ryan, have you read the book of Contact?
I have not read the book, I'm ashamed to say.
I think I can speak for all of us when I say we highly recommend it. It was really fun to talk about too. Yeah. But yeah, it also, you know, the book was written by Sagan kind of after his original plan to do this work on this film with Andrian had sort of been stuck in development hell. And so he just was kind of threw up his hands, I guess, and said, I'll just write the novel of it. And it's his only novel, and it's really lovely. But then eventually they did get the film made, just sadly after he had passed away. I think a year after he passed away, it came out. So,
Yeah. I'm gonna have to read it, or at the very least, listen to the episode.
Yes.
Probably spoilers. The very least. Yeah.
Yeah. So I know Molly had seen this beforehand. Tess, had you seen it?
I never had. Yeah. I loved it.
Oh, okay.
I saw it at the Beverly Center in 1997.
Woo!
Very specific memory of any movie I saw with a friend's family rather than my own family. I think I went with my friend Vanessa. And I was not a fan of Contact in 1997. And
how old were you then?
Like 13, I want to say.
You were still getting familiar with the cosmos.
You know, I'll go into my issues with the film as we continue, but I got to say on the rewatch, still didn't like the movie that much.
Really?
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Huh. Huge fan of the book.
I don't know that I would have liked it if I hadn't read the book. For some reason, I feel like having read the book and really enjoyed it made it a little bit easier for me to overlook some things I probably wouldn't have liked about the movie.
Hmm. Right.
My main problem with the movie is it is too goddamn long.
It's what?
Long. No.
That's not a problem with this movie.
It
there
is.
There are some other
it
things
is.
You could pick, but I never There's feel a, the length
that's
of this
my,
movie.
That's my main problem with it. It's too long. It just like drags on and on. There's a point where it like could and should end, and then it goes on for like another half hour with a courtroom drama. Just feel like there could have been some cuts made, Robert Zemeckis.
Since we already kind of covered the main plot and concept of the movie, I think, you know, we don't need to do too much remedial stuff on this. But basically, this is a movie about an astronomer named Ellie Arroway who discovers a radio telescope signal from the Vega system, which is the first contact that Earth has had with extraterrestrial life, ends up getting instructions through the signal to build a machine that will theoretically take her, in this case, just her, instead of a whole squad of scientists, because I guess that's how movies work. We didn't have enough time to meet the four other scientists that she was on the mission with, but goes and makes contact, but in a very specific and kind of personal way. So I this is probably like the movie that got me into all of this stuff to begin with, all the SETI stuff and radio astronomy and stuff like that. So it kind of introduced all those concepts to me, and I think visually and like cinematically it makes it all really compelling, like stuff that can be super dry and the book really conveys can be super dry and just like sitting around and watching a screen or listening to signals all day with not much coming through. So but I think this movie does a good job of like making it compelling and exciting, especially if you're like a younger viewer. I don't know,
how did you first see it? How old were you when you saw it, and how did you see it?
Oh, I didn't see it till late. I don't think I saw it till after after college, I'm sure.
Ryan, how about you?
I was thinking. I was so this came out. I was like my first year out of college, and I actually remember seeing this at Century City.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, you either saw it at the Beverly Center or you saw it at Century City. And so, yeah. And I think I remember not loving it when I first saw it, but I think thinking back in terms of its what, how old I was and kind of, I was kind of a pretentious little shit back then. I think I thought I was like too, there was something about it that wasn't cool, you know. I felt like I was like too cool for it at the time. I remember distinctly it being, and maybe it was something about like how I viewed Zemeckis at that point or something, but I remember feeling like a little above it when I saw it and kind of like, it's kind of silly and all the stuff at the end. But I gotta say, rewatching it, I've completely flipped around. I really loved it.
I'm
team Contact. All the way. And context, and like context wise, we actually, Karina and I totally coincidentally had watched this. We watched it like last week, and we watched it because we had watched Castaway and kind of, which both of these films Karina had never seen before. And both of them, on revisiting them, there were kind of revelations for me. I was kind of like, oh my God, I really love both these films, and these are really incredible. And so anyway, it was sort of a Zemeckissance festival.
So Contact, was that the first thing he made after Forrest Gump?
I'm thinking it was. I mean, because Forrest Gump was maybe there was one thing in between then. I'm going to look because I just had his IMDb open because I'm trying to get Zemeckis to win the blank check March Madness now.
I liked how you kept calling him Bobby Z.
Bobby Z. I mean, it is weird to think of Zemeckis as somebody whose work is like aging well, because, you know, most people just think of Forrest Gump or something, which I haven't watched since I was 15. And I am morbidly very curious to see how that holds up. I think probably
we should
not
do it
well.
Sometime. Yeah, maybe we'll do the Zemeckis series.
Yeah. If they don't do it on Blank Check, we'll do it here. But like, let's see what came after.
I saw Forrest Gump for the first time like 2 years ago.
Really?
What a weird movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
What year was Forrest Gump? What year was it?
94, I believe.
Yeah.
94. Wow. Jeez.
Yeah, 94. Contact was the follow-up. He did 3 episodes of Tales from the Crypt in between for some reason.
Yeah, because he's awesome, because Tales from the Crypt is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think my favorite Zemeckis movie is obviously Roger Rabbit, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So maybe that's where I was coming from. Maybe I was just like, this isn't as good as Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Were you really thinking of Forrest Gump in terms of Robert Zemeckis' like filmography when it came out in 1984?
No, I was saying...
Oh, when you saw it recently. Yeah.
And when I saw Contact at the time, I was like, this isn't as good as Roger Rabbit, the greatest movie I've ever seen.
I mean, it is apples and apples there.
Yeah. But I do think Contact, and this is not its fault, it does fall right into the golden age of boring scenes of people looking at computers and typing into them.
Hard disagree. This is the golden age. This is the golden age of that. So good. Oh, yeah. I love it. I love the janky Amiga graphics. Oh.
Do you have any idea what that, like, I thought I saw like a Unix logo in the corner there, and I did not, but I've never used Unix, and I was like, is this some extreme like period computing interface that they're using right here, or is this like a completely made up Hollywood interface? Because I love those.
It's like a fake Linux.
Yeah, something like that.
It looked pretty made up to me, but I don't know. It had the big readable window where you enter in. Yeah, I don't know. It. But at the same time, it was better. It was better than a lot of things, but it still falls into that wonderful, beautiful, gilded age of computer interfaces before there were people really were familiar enough with computer interfaces where they had to feel like they had to make it look realistic.
I would love to do a blog sometime or a Tumblr. I mean, this is maybe week 7 of quarantine of just all the like wonderful intervaces of that era that have no like when you think about using them, they're like there's not the only reason this exists is so that viewers can see the screen. Like this is a terrible interface otherwise.
I definitely thought that there were certain points where the people staring at computers was not my jam, mostly when they were in groups, but then I kind of loved like when Jodie Foster would come into her office and there would be that little like floating and flying envelope and it would be like you've got mail and I was like aww.
Yes.
I was into that. But yeah, I mean I think if I had seen this when it came out or closer to then, a lot of the kind of earnestness and sanctimonious vibes would have really turned me off, but now they just seem charmingly 90s to me. I mean, everyone takes themselves so super seriously in this movie and in the novel.
I will say my main beef with this movie in 1997 was the lack of chemistry between McConaughey and Jodie Foster.
And it's sort of peak like hot McConaughey or first wave. Like he's really great looking in this movie.
He's
as
good.
A Christian philosopher. Come on.
Yeah, no, he's really good and she's really good. They just like the there's just no chemistry between them, which I guess is the point, is that like he runs hot and she's like a scientist to her core. But I sort of felt like because it was a movie, they tried to structure it around the romance in a way. And I was like, no, just structure it about the romance of space.
Yeah. I mean, her and Palmer don't even like hook up in the book. There's like a flirtation, but there's not, they don't ever like she sleeps with multiple people in the book, but I don't think she ever sleeps with that character in the book. Am I forgetting it? Did I block it
out? I couldn't remember either.
I mean, it's definitely, they have like a romantic.
Yeah. It's just like a kind of like, it's a flirtation. It's sort of like an intellectual and emotional flirtation, like kind of like, oh, here's somebody I can butt heads with, that kind of thing. But, which is also like a great relationship to just have as is, like just have, even if it is flirtatious, just having this person that's sort of like your intellectual match, but also is coming from a completely different place than you are. Like that's a cool relationship in the book, I think. But it's not nearly as central. And it's funny when you like order this on iTunes, like the screen on the menu is just like a picture of them like staring into each other's eyes. Like that's the central relationship.
That's the contact that's going to be made.
Yes. Yeah.
I didn't think the romance though was, I don't know, the movie. I mean, I guess maybe if it's not there in the book, it's more present in the movie. But it, at the end of the day, the romance isn't that central to the film actually, and the whole kind of God or not God thing between them is a little bit more what the whole thing rests on. But yeah, it's there definitely. But I don't know. I didn't feel like the whole movie kind of hinged on it.
Yeah, and it kind of, I mean, it is sort of nice to see also that initial hookup that they have, and then it's like she drops the ball on it. Like she's the weird distant person who's too focused on her work to come back to bed with Matthew McConaughey, which is a little bit satisfying, especially for the time that this came out, I think. I think the thing that I was surprised by, to go back to the ending, Molly, that you were talking about, and the whole kind of courtroom part of it, and the James Woods grandstanding part of it, is just that, like, I think I appreciated that part more now having read the book, because it really kind of nails home that sort of, see, she ends up believing in faith, you know, type thing, which I think
boo.
but why boo? Why boo? I want to know why boo.
I feel just like in the, because I hate when space turns out to be God or your dead family in a movie.
It isn't
at all though, because that's what I liked about it, is they reframe the question of faith to be about, yeah, I don't know, it did this kind of like Svengali act, I think, where it kind of reframed faith to be her believing in something that is provable, and it's not, I don't know, it didn't frame it to me as kind of like pawning it off as God or an unknowable being. It was an alien intelligence. It was doing a thing for a reason. I don't know. Yeah, I had that same allergic reaction to stuff, but I didn't get that.
Yeah, I will say that like that worked fine for me in the book, which we talked about in the book club episode. I actually, for the first time, was like, oh, okay, this is the time when you see your dead family in space and it's okay. The only other example of this is Solaris. Mm. But I just feel like it's a cheat. Personally, I feel like the whole point of space is like you don't know what's out there. And then when they're like, here's what's out there, something comforting. It's like, no, it's not comforting. It's icy darkness. Oh, you know, nothingness.
You know, it's kind of interesting. The have you guys read the Three Body Problem? Emily, I think we talked about this.
Yeah, I haven't. I that's on my list still. I've heard nothing but good things. I really want to read it.
It's great. It's also, I mean, it's kind of that and even more so of Team Molly in terms of what you're talking about with.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, and it's almost to the point where, and those books are so effective, it's almost to the point where having read those, seeing this movie's perspective on alien life almost feels like when you're watching a movie and there's an airport and it's pre-9/11 and seeing people just like show up and just like walk onto the plane with their friend who's taking the flight, but they're not taking the flight. There's something about it that's such a huge disconnect. It makes this feel kind of Pollyanna-ish, but in a way that is kind of nice to watch a little bit.
Well, that is also every movie is like that now, because anytime anyone touches anyone,
right? Exactly.
We watched a movie at spring break last week, and that was the thing that freaked everybody out was all the touching.
So much contact, literally. Yeah, I mean, I think. Listen, I still don't think that the dad at the end, and I don't even love it in the book. Like, I don't think that the aliens taking on the form of her dad makes a lot of sense to me in either context. But I do think that this movie does sort of earn it, even though it's not my favorite thing, just because I do think it gets across the vastness and unknowability of space for a long time up until then. Like, the whole opening sequence is so fantastic. Yeah. Like, I think it's such a like shot across the bow, the zooming out from Earth with the radio signals, and how quickly it just goes quiet. Because basically what you're seeing is you're pulling away from Earth and going out through the solar system and through the Milky Way and out and out and out and out and following the radio signals that have made it to that point in space, just sort of illustrating, I think, really gracefully and visually that whole idea that the whole idea of this radio signal rests on, which is that, like, this is how long it takes for something to get there. This is why the Vegans found the signal of Hitler and why it takes this long for things to bounce back. You know, kind of illustrating that for people, especially for people who don't have any familiarity with that concept, but also doing it in a way where you're just like, ah, space is so big. Fuck.
Yeah.
That was the best part of the movie, I thought, is the opening.
Oh, you.
No, I mean, look, I'm a 2001 person. I want my space movies to be just, you know, there's no comfort left. You're not going to come out of this.
It was a little too 2010 for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I get.
Also, along with the people typing into computers furiously, which I also think is funny, you know, it's like people typing into a telegraph furiously. It's just like not very cinematic. And in the book, you're hearing what's happening in her head, and it just works a lot better. This was just one of those things where I was like, oh, this worked better for me as a novel because I like Carl Sagan explaining what's so interesting about this and just trying to reduce it to like a shot of Jodie Foster kind of staring off into the middle distance. Doesn't work as well for me.
But then you just sense. Like you miss the vibe of like the classic 90s crew of nerds in a room
I was
like that.
Just about to say one of the prime 90s tropes. There was like a 3-year window where every other movie had some chucklehead in a Hawaiian shirt.
Yep.
Philip Seymour Hoffman and Twister is kind of the prototype of that. And this movie had like the poor man's version of that. And it made me so happy. Just like, dude.
Or the guy in Titanic.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Jurassic Park, it's Newman, I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wayne Knight is his government name. Twister is a great movie.
Yeah, we've been overdue to talk about Twister for a long time. I think we were going to get Amy Nicholson.
Yeah,
to talk
I like
about.
Twister better than Contact in terms of crazy woman on a quest movies, which I do love, you know?
Yeah.
Woman obsessed with thing.
Yeah.
I think... Jodie Foster's really good in this movie, but yeah, there's just so much weird stuff in the book too that I was just like, why didn't they put in the weird future universe?
Oh right. Man. Yeah. So Ryan, I don't want to spoil the book for you too much, 'cause I do think you should read it. I think you would love it. But, like Haddon, the crazy billionaire funder of everything. Yeah. He's like, they kind of don't really specify what he's rich off of. It's like telecom type stuff or whatever in the movie. But in the book, he got rich off of ad blockers. And now with his billions, he runs a like sex playground in Manhattan called Babylon. It's amazing. He's a much more interesting, colorful character. I mean, he's pretty, like, he's kind of just like a Bond villain in the movie. Yeah. He's much more interesting in the book.
That was my biggest disappointment coming to the movie from the book. I was like, no, they took away all the fun Haddon stuff.
Yeah. They didn't have the budget for the sex playground for, like, people being brought in on palanquins by, like, shirtless guards and stuff. I mean, yeah.
That character does feel very relevant now, though, the sort of, like, evil billionaire with mysterious tech money funding projects mm-hmm. for their own pleasure.
Yeah.
I gotta say, the more I think about it also, I mean, not knowing all this cool stuff you guys are mentioning in the book, it also, though, it hammers home how, because I don't know, the movie is long, and kind of, I hadn't seen it in years. And when Karina, like, said, oh, we should watch Contact, the first thing I said was, you know, it's like 3.5 hours long, right? And we looked at it, and it's actually, it's not. It's, what is it, like 2 hours and 20 minutes or something?
Yeah,
it's
like,
especially by today's standards, it's not an incredibly long movie. It didn't actually feel long to me. It felt really well paced. Yeah. And thinking about it, it's actually a really well, in terms of the writing, it's a really well structured movie. Even the way that they seed the stuff with the way that they play the father stuff through every single element of it, mm-hmm. including how that's a big part of the McConaughey romance is her kind of like lacking, you know, her missing, you know, her dad, and having that play all the way up to the end. I don't know. It's actually a pretty tight movie in terms of thematically the whole thing's put together and structured.
Yeah.
Somebody responded to my Twitter by saying they thought this is the best of the Daddy Issues in Space movies.
it's a big field. There's a lot of daddies in space.
It's a big field. Just like once I would like them to go to space and there's just like a big blob, you know?
A big monolith. A big unknowable monolith or something.
Oblivion, Molly, the Tom Cruise movie.
Oh, Oblivion. Yeah.
There's a big blob in space.
Yes, indeed.
Is that a Daddy Issues in Space movie?
No, it's like, it's just wife issues in space.
Same thing. I prefer the Daddy Issues in Space movies to the dead wife in space movies.
Yeah.
Again, exception for Solaris, the only good one.
No, but the blob in Oblivion is voiced by somebody really funny. Who is it? It's like an esteemed actress, like a respected stage actress or something. I can't remember. Oh.
Is it Dame Judi Dench? Wearing her cat's makeup. Actually, that's what I want, is you get to space and Dame Judi Dench is there and she greets you in her cat makeup.
That's space. When you get farther far enough in space, Dame Judi Dench for cats is waiting for you.
My favorite sci-fi, like, I like Stanislaw Lem, who wrote the book that Solaris is based on. Mm-hmm. Like, in all of his books, the aliens turn out to be something that the human mind cannot comprehend.
Did he also write Stalker? Did he also write the book? No, the book that Stalker is based on?
Possibly.
No. I don't know. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, he's sort of like, he's your Eastern Bloc hard sci-fi guy.
Yeah.
But a lot of his books are like, the alien intelligence is just like an algae that you cannot communicate with, but you like are reading its mind somehow.
Yeah.
I like that. The beach in this movie looked like the beach from The Beach.
Well, it's a rendering. It's I think that the visual effect of the beach is really effective still, even given the time and the digital effects they were working with, because it is sort of that kind of uncanny, poreless, Polar Express, Zemeckis Polar Express type look where you're just like, this is slightly off. And I think that ultimately, like, I'm not so mad at the dad stuff at the end because I do think that that's what they're getting at. I think that they're getting at the fact that these aliens are not comprehensible to humans. So they have to take on this form because otherwise she would just be like, you know, talking to a six dimensional dust or something, you know.
That's what I want. Show me the six dimensional dust.
I'm
like
sure Bobby Z's working on it. But yeah.
Tess, what do you think? Tess, what are your feelings on the beach?
I mean, I see what you're saying. Well, the beach I loved, and I totally agree with Emily that it's so smooth that it kind of like, you know, sublimates you. You're just like, ooh, I'm slipping into this green screen craziness. But I also, Molly, I hear what you're saying, but I'm curious what you would want from an interaction. Like, are you talking just a very brief moment between heroin and blob? Or like, do you really want to see like the blob and Jodie Foster interact, like the giant dust mote and Jodie Foster having like a long arc there?
I guess I want this to be a different movie than it is, which is not what it wants to be.
Do you want it to be Arrival? Because Arrival has a lot of
maybe,
interfacing with...
I do feel like Arrival is the version of this that I like more. And I feel like part of the reason is like trying to fit the novel Contact into a blockbuster form just feels like it sands off some of the edges of what made Contact the book so interesting and good to me.
I think that the prose in the novel was unexpectedly great. Like, I think we were all kind of surprised by how well Sagan could do fiction, and we were like, you know, it was a very gripping novel, and more than I expected. So, I mean, yeah, like, you lose a lot of the interiority, and eventually, I do agree that the McConaughey-Foster chemistry was, like, a little lackluster, and it was such a sideline plot in the book, so it was kind of unfortunate that that took up so much space. But I mean, I don't know, I had low expectations, maybe because I knew Molly hated the movie. And so I was just like, what? From the opening shot, I was like, okay, I can get with this is fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think still this, I think that the parts that you want a movie to deliver on, when you're making the translation, especially with like this kind of really big scale sci-fi material, I think that Zemeckis just hits it out of the park. I just think all of the buildup to her, the mission, and then the entire actual mission is just so well done. And like, and the only thing that kind of bumps a little bit is the CGI compass, like that's the only part where I'm like, oh, I'm watching a CGI from 1997. Other than that, I think that visually it totally works, and it's got a little bit of that just like mind-bending 2001 quality, just like this super cinematic, super visual, in a way that, you know, that's the one thing that a movie can do that a book can't do. And I cry every single time when she's just keeps yelling, like, I'm okay to go, I'm okay to go. I just, it's so exciting, and it's so, it's just, for something that's so heady for most of the film, most of the story, like, it just becomes, it's just exciting to see somebody get to do the thing they've always dreamed of doing their entire life. And I think that Foster pulls it off amazingly. I think the film is just like, that's like the peak of the film for me.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I also, that one shot of the CG compasses, it's disconcertingly bad because there are so many. And the other thing is, there are so many effect shots in this movie.
Yeah.
This is an incredibly effects heavy movie. And most of it is stuff that like, you can't really tell. There's so much good effects work in the film.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. The amount that doesn't bump for us with our modern eyes is really a testament to, which is the other crazy thing about Castaway also, is that it's a very much a stealth effects movie. But, but anyway, with this, but the other thing that's incredible about this is the sound design.
Yeah.
The sound design, this film is freaking fantastic.
It's so good. It's so scary. And the sound of the signal, I wonder who did. I want to look up the sound.
Look it up.
Sure it's sound design. The sound design is great. Yeah, I think it's also like, it just opens in such a cool, spiritual, interesting way, you know, that makes all the points the movie wants to make, which is like, you know, science that you can't understand is indistinguishable from God. But yeah. then it just like becomes a regular movie. So I think it's also like, I don't know. It's like, I want it to be made now almost. And there is something about sort of the effects overload. It's like right before everything got so effects heavy that I started to hate it, you know?
Yeah.
It's like they're still using it somewhat sparingly, even though you can tell they want to like put it on everything. But my favorite part is when all the UFO weirdos show up at the launch site. Yeah. And apparently those people all brought their own costumes and are real UFO weirdos. Awesome. Yeah, they just put out a casting call for like people who are interested in UFOs, and they all just showed up. That's my favorite part, is the UFO music festival.
Well, that's like the night call dream there.
It
the,
is.
The descent to the desert. Yeah.
And is it Gary Busey or his son?
No, it's his son.
It's his son, yeah.
His son. Yeah. I also like James
Bobby.
Woods.
I want to say Bobby, his name is Bobby Busey. It's not.
I also love James Woods playing 2020 James Woods.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Really great casting on that front. Yeah.
Yeah. Angela Bassett is in this movie.
Angela Bassett is great. Yeah.
It has a great cast.
Yeah. What is Gary Busey's son's name? I'm trying to find it now. Also, I can't.
Sean Busey.
I can't find anything. Oh, Jake Busey.
Jake Busey. Busey.
I mean, what a face. What a face to have pop up on your security camera right before an explosion.
Well, it's funny because I forgot about that part. And when we were watching it, my boyfriend was like, oh, did you get up to the part where the Busey blows it up? And I was like, what are you talking about? and then when we got to that part and they show him like looking at the screen before he does it, it's so scary.
It's scary. Oh, also Rob Lowe as the fundy guy, the fundamentalist dude that's like the more hardcore version of McConaughey.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rank, who's also a character in the book, but I had forgot that Rob Lowe played him, which is also good casting. Yeah, that stuff is all
great. I think Rob Lowe forgot.
Yeah. And then William Fichtner, a great William Fichtner role.
Yes, William Fichtner.
We stan. I have wanted to do a podcast about William Fichtner with William Fichtner for a really long time. This has been a dream of mine. So if anybody has a Fichtner connection, I want to go through his filmography.
He was on Jonesy's Jukebox once.
Oh, really?
Really?
Because they're friends. And he was so funny and cool. And I was like, he always plays such like scary characters.
Yeah.
Or in this case, he plays like a cool blind guy.
A sweetie.
But he was such a sweetie on Jonesy. And he swims laps at the La Cañada Rec Center. So if you need to go look for him.
He doesn't still live in Buffalo, New York.
He's Angelino.
His IMDb profile is still like from, it seems like it's from his theater days in like regional theater days in upstate New York. And it's like, William Fichtner still brings joy to residents of the greater Buffalo, New York area.
He has kind of an accent too. He has like a good like Buffalo accent in real life. He seems like somebody who in the 70s would have been the star of every movie and in the 90s got relegated to being like the seventh guy.
That's a great call. Yeah, 100%.
You know, he's like too interesting and weird and cool.
Yeah.
He's so good in Go. I love him in Go.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, yeah.
One thing I also thought was funny, even though they also do this in the book, it was much funnier in the movie every time they talk about the aliens and call them vegans.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But did they say vegans, though?
They say vegans, but I had closed captioning on at one point and was like,
well,
vegans?
It also made me think of, it threw me to Vogons. It had a double thing.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Well, I feel like around this time, like, I feel like one of the first people I was aware of being vegan was Alicia Silverstone. And I think people were still pronouncing it vegan because nobody knew how to pronounce vegan then. This is a weird 1997 era memory I have. So maybe it was interchangeable at that point.
Would you guys, if an alien sent you plans for a machine, but the first broadcast they sent you was Hitler, would you get in the machine?
If scientists explained it to me, sure.
Tess? Tess, how about you, Tess?
You know me so well. Of course I would not get on that machine. They could show me, they could send back a broadcast that was like, you know, not even Hitler. And I would still be like, I think I'm good. I'm going to stay where I am.
Yeah. I would get in that machine so hard. Oh my God. Like, I also think it's a little far fetched to think that there would be like a widespread like competition to get into the machine, like a big, like,
no,
like I don't think a lot of people would want
not,
to.
No, that's not far fetched. Cause remember they did that Mars competition.
Oh, the Mars one. And I met somebody who was a finalist for that. And then they, you know, it ended up being kind of debunked like a hoax. And I think he was really bummed out about it.
Yeah, because he wanted to go to Mars.
And his wife was not happy about him going to Mars. It was just like the guy in the movie who was like, my kids cried at me and said I can't go to space, so I guess fuck my kids, I'm staying here on Earth. Like,
by the end of this quarantine, we will all want to go to Mars, and we will all want our significant others to go to Mars. The kids are going to Mars. We're all going
to
go.
I think the quarantine gives us a better idea of what it would be like to live on Mars than we've ever had before. And I think most of us are not that into it.
No, super not into it.
But you know what? You bring it up an interesting point, which is like, if you could go to the beach on Mars, well, if you could just have the complete illusion of being outside on
like
Earth, which is like what you would need to keep people sane.
Yeah,
sure. You need to have an experience orb for people.
Ryan, would you get in the machine?
Yes. If I had Jodie Foster explain the Hitler thing to me, which, by the way, the Hitler thing is hilarious. Like, like big belly laugh from me.
It got a laugh from me in the book because I'm in an anti-Olympics organization.
Yes.
I was like... Yeah, that was the first time they broadcast the Olympics on television and created all of the things they always do in the Olympics, like the torch race. So yeah, I would not get in a machine. I think history has taught me not to get in any machines operated by people affiliated with Hitler. So
yes, the aliens are definitely being like, we're affiliated with this guy. We love it. It's also funny to see, like, James Woods has a really good reaction to when they finally get, like, de-scramble the Hitler image, where he's just like, okay. It's just funny to see James Woods specifically doing that reaction to that.
Maybe it would be scarier if they sent something really, like, cutie, if it was like, I'm so harmless, get in this weird triple beam machine. But
it's a cookbook. It's a cookbook.
Exactly. Exactly. I did read some stuff about the machine. I thought the machine was cool, the three rings thing. Mm-hmm. And I read that it was actually designed for Terminator 2.
Well, another a little interesting tidbit here. Ed Varro, the production designer for this movie, did Looper. I worked with Ed on Looper.
Oh,
cool.
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, I did love the production design in this movie.
Very cool.
Apparently, this was like a thing they designed for Terminator 2, this like three-ring sphere thing, and then they didn't end up using it in Terminator 2, so they repurposed it as the design for the contact machine.
But and that's all the same production? That was your production designer as well, who designed the machine? Or
I guess he must, unless they had like a, I mean, Ed did the movie. I don't know in terms of the machine whether that was him or whether they brought in someone.
One thing I've learned recently is that a lot of concept art gets reused.
Yeah, it does. No, it's true. Yeah,
I was watching Citizen Kane, and one thing I had never noticed about it before is that the birds that fly over Xanadu are actually pterodactyls from King Kong.
Yeah. Wait, what?
Yeah, because they like ran out of money for effects, and
that's
were like,
amazing.
What do we have at the studio? You can't really tell. I think the art of Xanadu is also some sci-fi or fantasy concept art, actually.
And they were putting it all together after the fact, so they were just like, and that great transition with that crazy bird, whatever it is,
eye
you can see through. That was just through, I forget what that was from, but it was something from something funky like that. Yeah, they were basically, it was like when they were making Revolution Number 9, they were just kind of grabbing scraps of whatever they had around the studio and saying, how can we use this? Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, which is cool because you don't think that the first few times you watch those movies, and then maybe 100 times later, you're like, oh, that makes sense.
Right.
I only realized Xanadu was in Florida this watch, even though they say that, because I just associated it so much with California and Hearst Castle.
Yeah.
I also read some people saying the three rings in the machine are, you know, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost.
Oh, really? How does that work?
That mind-body problem?
I just assumed it was like... whatever. I don't know what science. I'm not the person to guess at what the science is behind the three rings. But I mean, it is just supposed to open up a, like, it's just supposed to spin fast enough to bend time or something, right? Like,
it's
bend
like space the time. Seashells from Demolition Man. It doesn't actually matter how it works. Yeah. It's just like, yeah, that looks like a thing that would take you to space. Sure.
I do like how it's like it's a subplot. I think it's also in the book, but that they're so insistent on having a seat with restraints in it because they like don't trust that the aliens will like know about, you know, like car safety. And then that's like the only thing that's fucking up the machine. Like that's why it's so like she's rattling around so badly is because she's stuck in this chair, which is just like a little we didn't trust God's plan. God, i.e. space.
Is that a knock on Ralph Nader that they're trying to get in there?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's from the book. Speed? I think it was in the book as well. Yeah. Like, I don't know.
Well, my dad's been reading a book about 2001, and he said he just... one of the big things they talk about in the book is that Arthur C. Clarke and Carl Sagan hated each other.
Wow, that makes sense.
It totally makes sense, because they are totally like the Jodie Foster and the McConaughey characters in terms of their view on space.
Right.
That makes
sense. I've been meaning to read that book. Does he say it's good?
Yeah, he said it's really good. He said he thought there was nothing that he didn't know about this movie, but there's apparently a lot. But I guess Carl Sagan like came to set as an advisor, and Arthur C. Clarke was like, get that loon the fuck out of here. This is Arthur C. Clarke country.
Wow. I would love to read that. Wait, what's the book called?
Can we start a book club with your dad?
Yeah, totally. You and my dad definitely read a lot of the same books.
Just World War I books. And let's do it.
Does anybody have any more thoughts on the movie or, you know, favorite parts or, I don't know, things that stick with you?
Did you see like, because everyone always tweets about this shot and it is a pretty cool shot, but it's the mirror.
Oh, the mirror shot. Yeah.
Yeah. Which
it's pretty wild. It's pretty insane.
Yeah.
I also don't know why it is. It's other than being like a cool flex. I kind of feel
the opposite about it. I feel like it's almost like, I don't know, like I don't know that I necessarily would have noticed it and went like, whoa, if I hadn't had it pointed out to me. I think it's actually, for me, it's like kind of an example of, you know, when people kind of ding Zemeckis for just being kind of effects heavy. To me, that's a shot that actually works in terms of like the emotion of it coming through, like surmounting the fact that it's this crazy effect. You wouldn't even really know it was unless you... had it kind of played back and dissected, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it feels, you guys know what we're talking about, the when she's remembering her dad's death and it's that shot of her running down the hall with little Jenna Malone running down the hallway, and then it ends up being the reflection in the mirror. I guess the one, if I had to like make up a reason for it to be there, just it's like kind of, I guess, is what a memory actually feels like, is that you're like kind of seeing it through a mirror or something. But it's cool.
Yeah, and all the childhood scenes take place in a very good fake autumn.
Yes. Yeah.
Which also feels like this is your memory filtered through time.
I do have to say that Jenna Malone being a young Jodie Foster works so, so well. Like, they really, really look like the same person.
It works very well, and yet not as well as Kristen Stewart as her daughter in Panic Room.
Totally.
Looking like a clone. And there was a period after this movie where, I mean, it is interesting. Like, Jodie Foster is just an interesting movie star because it is like she got famous so young and she got sexualized so young. And then she got so famous that she could, like, opt out of being sexualized.
Yeah.
Because she was powerful.
You know what
she's
movie?
She's always so good. She's always so good.
Yeah.
And she's, like, I think she's...
She's always great. Always I love her... I love her in Inside Man when she's like bad guy. I feel like she has a whole villain career that could be further explored.
I really want to watch Nell. I have never seen Nell in my life.
Nell is one of these
things that just exists as an idea in my mind from that era. Like,
I hated Nell.
Wait, what did you say?
I have a very strong negative reaction to Nell. As soon as anyone mentions Nell, I feel compelled to be like, don't do it. Don't do it. Think about it. Think about
what
you're
doing. I'm so curious, though. It's like opening up some box from your past.
I've never seen it, but I do sometimes go like Tay in the Wind.
Chicopee.
Which is one of the things.
Chicopee.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
One of the things she says. Maybe I should watch Castaway.
Did she direct Nell? Oh, you should watch Castaway.
Yeah, Castaway. Oh, yeah. As soon as you said you were watching Castaway, I was like, okay, cue that up. That's the mood.
Yeah.
It's pretty
also loved when people were using stills from Castaway in fake news stories about Tom Hanks under quarantine.
Yes.
They were like, someone gave him a volleyball. It was like, this is a still from Castaway. But also sort of like emblematic of our insane world that like enough people couldn't tell that they like reposted it.
Nell was directed by Michael Apted.
I was wondering if she directed that.
No.
Which movies is... Because she's... Which What's movies first... has she directed?
Yeah. She...
Apparently people were mad at her or just giving her a lot of shit during the Contact phase of her career because it was when she had her first child and people were angry that she wouldn't reveal the baby daddy because she was still closeted. But it was kind of like a glass closet where people, you know, knew that she was gay, but she didn't want to be out about it. So I remember people being really, really dicks to her about the fact that they were like, you're a movie star. You can't have a private life.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Her first film was Little Man Tate that she directed. And then she did Home for the Holidays and then a long gap. And then, you knew it, The Beaver.
The Beaver.
That's right.
Has anyone seen it? Have you seen The Beaver?
I have never seen The Beaver. I would like to watch The Beaver again.
Yeah,
just
I
want to
watch it too.
Pure curiosity. she did produce Nell. But yeah. But yeah, Jodie Foster has some problematic friends, but I still think she's a legend and a lover.
Also, like, compared to any problematic man in Hollywood, she's like, all she's doing is still being friends with them. She's not the person, you know, doing the sugar tits thing. Like,
right.
She's just refusing to disavow them, which is also not great, but
not great.
Not as bad as Oh, she plays the villain in Elysium, which I actually haven't seen.
Oh my God. Yeah. Elysium's a little bit of a stinker. But
she was terrific in Hotel Artemis.
Oh yeah.
She was terrific. She was
also
like badass in that. Yeah, she was great.
Yeah, I really
like
that.
She also says she's in one episode of The X-Files and one episode of Frasier. I have to assume in Frasier she's a call-in.
Oh, yeah. She's probably one of their celebrity call-ins.
Nice.
But yeah, it does seem like she made Silence of the Lambs and then got to be the only actress who gets to play like intelligent, desexualized women.
Yeah.
For a super long time. She just owned that lane.
I really want to rewatch Flight Plan.
Yeah, I'm just looking at her.
It's the lady vanishes on the plane. Just think of that log line. It's like,
I want to see this movie she's in from 1980 called Carney, about carnies.
I vaguely remember that movie. Yeah.
Directed by Robert Kaler, and it's about a waitress who becomes a carney.
Oh my God, that sounds great.
I want to watch
that. I'm watching that this afternoon.
Well, maybe our next movie club can just be the entire filmography of Jodie Foster and or William Fichtner. We could just
Freaky
super
Friday. Have you guys seen Foxes?
No.
Foxes
is great.
Yeah.
Foxes is her and Sherry Curry from The Runaways, and it's about just like sort of neglected teens in the Valley in the 80s, early 80s. I love it.
Well, that I think will do it for our first episode of the Night Call Movie Club. I have to really think about each of those four words. I'm gonna
practice
Night
Club Movie Call.
The Night Club Movie Call. I mean, kind of that feels also right. I mean, the movie call. We're on a movie call right now. We're doing this over Skype. This is a movie call. Thank you so much, Ryan, for joining us and kicking off this series. And thanks for watching Contact and going to space with us.
It was my pleasure because it's a great movie. Last word. Boom. Great. Oh, click.
Roll credits.
We win.
Ryan, my only suggestion now is if you could please make 3 rings out of sourdough and assemble them into a,
oh my
into
God.
A machine. That's like weak. Close Encounters.
Oh, and then that could be
never seen.
That could be how you send the starter to me, is by opening up a portal with the 3 rings of bread.
Except you won't get the actual starter. It'll just be your father.
I can't do anything with this. Oh my God.
The sand on the beach that she leaves behind does seem a little bit like yeast.
Yeah.
We'll be back with more space baking on Night Call.
And thank you as always for supporting the Night Call Patreon. Tell your friends about us if they're Night Call fans, or even if they're not. We've got tons of cool premiums coming out for our $10 and up subscribers. We have our monthly newsletter and 2 bonus episodes a month for our $5 supporters. So we've got lots of stuff coming down the pipeline in these very strange days and lonely nights. So thank you as always for listening and supporting, and we'll be back soon. I don't know when.
We will see you all soon on a beach in space.